This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
This week on Meatin' 3, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture, luxury ice and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy actually for the bikes to spin upside down or slip or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, Darren speaks to the art of plating. We talk about the start of the site and how plating has taken visuals of food to another level and how you can add a little beauty to your plate. And then live in studio, we have Abe Seaforth on his new record, Solstice One, and how we can return to nature through abstract, improvisational, electronic music. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Dara Bresnitz. We are here with Maria Nguyen, founder and editor-in-chief of The Art of Plating. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you so much.
So you got started in graphic design and web design, I would say earlier than most people do. You got started at the ripe old age of 12.
Yes.
What drew you to that instead of drawing on paper or the more classic, you know, teen art endeavors?
I think what drew me to that is, I can't draw.
Sure.
But I always had a really good eye for design. And I think what really drives me is like curiosity. And so at the time when I started getting into graphic design was when the internet just started like, you know, exploding. And there was this concept of a website, which I was like, what is a website?
What year is this?
This was maybe, I don't know, 2002, 2011.
Okay.
So very early on. Yeah. And, you know, I was like, what is a website? What is that? And then, you know, one of my cousins, she's a little bit older than me. She's like, oh, this is a website. And then there's like these websites where you could code it yourself and design. So I started playing around with Paint because that's what everybody does when you have a computer, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's always nice to have that older cousin who's like, this is cool. And you're all right, this is cool.
So then I was like, okay, well, I want to make a website.
Yeah.
And I opened up Paint and I designed my first website and I got into like coding at a really early age.
So the back end stuff and things like that, beyond just like here's some clip art up on a web page.
Yeah. So I got into like learning how to do HTML and CSS.
That's awesome.
Getting real nerdy with it.
No, that's great. That stuff is still completely foreign to me. I had a computer science class that I did not do very well in.
Yeah.
And was food there early on as well? Or, you know, was it mostly design at the beginning?
It was mostly design at the beginning.
And did you, I know you went off to college and things like that, but with design, you're like, this is what I'm doing. You're drawn to the, not just the back end, but the coding, the beauty part of the design. Did you go to study it in college?
Yeah, I did. So, you know, after that, I started getting into like just designing and I learned how to do Photoshop. And it was just something that I was focusing on and kind of building my skill set. And I knew right away that was something I wanted to do. I went to school for it. I went to college for it. Then I got out of college and, you know, right away got into a design job.
And when did you feel that you had an eye? Like, you know, they talk about having the eye and like having an eye for this and an eye for design, but like, when did you start to feel that confidence that you had something unique and you saw things in a way that no one else could?
Probably at 12, 13.
Beautiful.
Like really early on.
That is very awesome to have that right out of the bat.
Yeah.
And so after college, you came to LA.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you to LA? Because design in the late aughts and things like that, LA was burgeoning and it had a scene, but New York seemed like maybe a stronger beacon. What brought you out here?
I moved to LA because, one, I'm attached to my car.
Oh, there you go.
And I don't do the snow. And I had the choice between LA or New York.
Sure.
And I just decided on a whim, you know, I'm going to move to LA. And then I didn't even have a job at the time. I didn't even know anybody here. I just figured I'll move to LA.
Sight unseen?
Yeah.
Had you been here before?
No, I hadn't. And I just had like a gut feeling that I was like, LA seems pretty cool. I want to move to LA.
What year was this?
This was 2011.
Okay. And so what were those early days like moving out to LA, being a designer? When did food start entering your world and your sphere?
Probably, you know, I always loved food.
Mom cooked, grandma cooked.
My family's Vietnamese, so food's like a big important thing to us. And, you know, food is always really important. And all of our family interactions was always around the meal, like around the table. So, you know, that was always really important to me. But so funny thing is, I grew up in Florida,
okay,
which is like, I shouldn't even be saying that.
No, you can say that.
No, but I grew up in Florida. And back there, at that time period too, like food, like really good food didn't really exist. I mean, there's a lot of chain restaurants.
No.
It's not a lot of culture. And my parents, they grew up in they worked all the time.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a place where I didn't get to travel and get to experience different cultures. So even though that was something I always wanted, I never really got to experience that. But then moving to LA, which is so completely different, there's like a plethora of culture and food.
Sure.
And, you know, moving out here, that's what I wanted to explore.
And it's amazing because now it's sort of swung back the other way where it's like, what are the subcultures in the towns? It seems like they have no subcultures. And it's like, you know, immigrant food or like mom's cooking or like this small like barbecue shack. But back then it was like, unless you lived in these specific cities in 2011, your food was Applebee's.
Yeah.
So you've always enjoyed food.
Right.
But, you know, Vietnamese food, especially home-cooked Vietnamese food, is definitely a different aesthetic than what you see on the art of plating. Because sure. It's a little bit more familiar. It's a little bit, I mean, it's beautiful in a way that maybe folk art mm-hmm. is beautiful, not in, like, the Grand Impressionist masters.
Yeah.
But you're doing design work, and when did you start to feel that something, like you're seeing a hole in the design community that you're like, I think I can fill this.
Mm-hmm. I think it was less about seeing a hole in the design community as much as it was a hole in the food community.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Go on.
And I say that because at that time, okay, so I had this client, right, who he sucked all the creativity out of me.
Mm, don't you love them? They're like, you're like, I've given you everything. And he's like, I need just a little more.
No, it was more of like, you suck. Start over. So it was more of like that. It was tough. And being the fact that I always love food, I was just like, okay, you know, I want to get into something different. I want to get into cooking. So one of my first cookbooks that I was running through was Thomas Keller's French Laundry.
Just a small, easy to approach cookbook.
And it's an amazing cookbook because I learned so much.
Yeah.
But every recipe, if you're doing the entire thing, it takes you 8 or 9 hours.
It's a long time because just the base, you're like, oh, it's 7 ingredients. Oh, wait, there's 12 sub recipes.
Exactly. You're making a little herb oil for an hour. and that's just barely the recipe, right? So I would be working through these recipes, and at the end of them, my food looked like shit compared sure. to the photos. And I was just thinking...
I mean, you picked, I mean, one of the highest... I mean, that's first off, that's a legendary, beautiful cookbook.
Sure.
But the food itself is just, you're like, wait, what did I do wrong? Which step of the 600 steps was that? But you're looking at it, and you go like, I don't feel as good about it, or like, you feel like something's missing.
I feel like I don't feel as good about it.
Sure.
And it doesn't feel as clean. And I was just more so curious to how he made it so beautiful and what steps did he take to make it that way. Kind of, you know, because everything, even with art, there's a little bit of rules or there's a foundation sure. to be built upon. And I just didn't really understand that as somebody cooking at home.
Right. And so you start seeing this opening in food because there's a way to transfer. And now let's remember, this is 2011, 2012. This is not the world we live in now where there's all a ton of YouTube videos, Facebook videos about like the behind the scenes.
Exactly. And it wasn't even a topic that anybody was talking no. about. Now you could get videos and there's articles and their websites and obviously Instagram pages. But at that time, it just didn't really exist. And so I was thinking, if there's no books or magazines or anybody focused on plating, I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one with this issue or mm-hmm. I'm not the only one who's interested into it. So I'm going to try it out on social media. And the first night was 50 followers and the next night was 100. And
what were you using? Which social media platform?
Instagram.
Oh, yeah. All right. I forgot they've been around for that long.
Yeah, yeah.
You must have been one of the first sort of food-focused design pages.
Sure. Now there's so many.
But there's... Well, we're going to get to that in a little bit because you don't need to talk... You don't want to talk too much about the competitors. But 50, 100, and like, were people just gobbling it up?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, now it's, you know, we've grown. We have over 760,000 followers.
But let's go back to those early days.
Yeah.
What was that like? What pressures did you put upon yourself? Or were there pressures that you didn't even feel because it was so new and you're like, who cares if anyone sees this because no one might see it at all?
I don't know. I don't think that there was really any pressures at all. I mean, I always had like an entrepreneurial spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always knew I wanted to build it into something meaningful. But at the same time, I was an art director too at an agency. So I always kind of have that self-pressure anyways to have sure. perfection. And so everything that I do is always extremely curated and I try to make it perfect.
Now, did you have a team or was it all just you at the beginning?
It was all just me. But the great thing was that I was so into it that I'd wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning and that was the first thing that I would do. And then lunch and dinner and before I went to sleep.
Now, how did you make that jump from not feeling that you're measuring up to Thomas Keller, which is totally fine. I feel like I've never measured up to Thomas Keller ever. But how did you make that design jump? And what was your approach to making something where you're like, okay, this is good enough for me to say, this is art, I've hit the design aesthetic of this plate, I'm going to put it on Instagram.
Mm-hmm. You know, but in the beginning too, it was less about actually creating the beautiful plates as much as it is showcasing.
Mm.
So we right now too, we work with tons of chefs and restaurants all over the world. And, you know, and in the beginning, it was more so about building a community and giving people a space to share their work.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about the launch of the website and then your growth, some of the awards, your dip into experiential, and how you pick the perfect plate. We have a song from the archives on Snacky Tunes here on heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your... Sorry. Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm here with Maria Nguyen, founder and editor-in-chief of The Art of Plating, whose Instagram, if you ever just want to bliss out over beautiful plates of food, just put on the Four Seasons, start scrolling down. But before you built, which is like, it seems like an endless page of like craftily curated photos, you had to launch, right? And so you have this Instagram page. How did you make that leap from having this be your side hustle to your main hustle? How did you get started in the dot-com
So probably a year into, you know, building the Instagram page, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, there needs to be something a little bit with more substance. So for the entire year after building the Instagram page, we launched the website, mm-hmm. and that was a place to do interviews and showcase videos and kind of pulling in all of our inspirations into one website.
And did you feel that it was a different approach now that you weren't dealing with just a photo and a caption, bringing more of like an editorial lens to it?
Yeah, for sure.
Because one of the things that I love about the website and things is that it's storytelling. And how do you tell a story through a plate of food or through a couple of plates of food? What are the stories you want to tell?
Mm-hmm. I think what really inspires us as a team and what we do is more so about the creativity of things. So that's kind of like the catalyst of everything that we do, is, you know, focusing on what inspires a chef. Because I always think plating is a really big personal expression. Hmm. Every person is so different and so unique, and they have their own kind of backstory of why they do the things that they do. You know, we've worked with one chef, Rasmus Kofed from Granium, and what he does is he's inspired by like the forest that he grew up in, and so everything is kind of like a little reminds him of his childhood. And so like those stories are so unique, and I think that's what kind of pushes us, is to be able like to tell those stories.
Yeah, I mean, you must see and get insights into these people through their food, that because sometimes chefs are introverts. Mm-hmm. You know, and you meet them and you're like, does he like me? Does she like me? And then they start plating their food and feeding you, and it's a whole other experience. How are you able to translate that through the work that you do?
Mm-hmm. I think I've been pretty lucky that a lot of chefs, they love talking about their work.
There you go. There you go.
So that definitely gives me the upper hand a little bit, to be able to ask them questions and kind of dive deep into their personalities and why, you know, they do the things that they do.
Now, a lot of the times, cooking in the higher and upper echelons are referred to culinary arts, with the emphasis being on the culinary, but you really emphasize the art part of it. Have you had a hard time convincing people, the public, the art side of it being equally or sometimes even more important than the food on the plate?
Yeah, I think that there is a, you know, good mixture of feedback. But for the most part, we've had really, really good mixture, because a lot of the things that we showcase is just so beautiful that it's hard not to appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the photos that you see that you get are just like, they're so perfect, and sometimes they're like too perfect. Do you ever struggle with that, of finding that balance of making it more realistic instead of this, you know, curated perfect page?
A little bit sometimes, but I think because we have, everyone on our team has a background or understands culinary, that we try to choose things that are realistic.
Right.
That is edible. Like, you know, I hate things, and not because I'm a person that goes out to eat too, I hate things that are overly frivolous, and I work with a lot of chefs, so I have a better understanding of what makes sense and what doesn't. It's not like, you know, the things that we are putting on there are just the most out of whack thing.
Yeah, I mean, now that you've been in this, now that this is full time, how has your curatorial approach shifted over the years? Especially, do you respond to trends? Is it more just going off that gut that you, that eye that you developed when you were 12? How do you pick where you shoot, where you eat, with the stories that you want to tell?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think it's more of a gut instinct. We're always trying to find chefs and people, and, you know, people who are doing things that are different than what you'd normally see, because there are trends. It's hard not for there to be trends. It's almost kind of like fashion in a way. You know, when an amazing chef is doing something incredible, it's hard not to pick up what he's doing and see a million other people to do it. So we try to find, you know, people who are just doing things a little bit more unique.
So the website's up. It's up a couple of years. The awards start coming in for some of the short films you make. Savor calls you best design blog. When do things start shifting? When do things start solidifying in your mind and around the content you're putting out? Be like, oh, this is a real thing. This is a real endeavor. And what we're saying is breaking through, making a point, and being recognized.
Mm-hmm. Probably in year two. is when...
Which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
I mean,
good.
Actually, early on, I always knew. But year two was when I felt that, okay, we're in a great place. And this is when I quit my job, too.
How was that day?
It was awesome.
How long had you been thinking about it?
For a whole year.
Did you give him 2 weeks? Were you nice like
that? I gave a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very nice. That's very nice. Did they know at work about your side hustle?
They did.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long?
From the beginning. Because at the time I was an art director and I was so close to everybody.
Sure.
The company that they all kind of knew. And I think everybody was really proud of me. And and even people who are just, you know, my colleagues, they're all really proud that I kind of just left them.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you left them with enough time. And at some point, they're probably looking at and they're probably... starting to realize, like, oh, this is becoming a real thing. She may not be with us forever. But so you leave and you take that leap, and is that when things just took off even more? Like, because you were able to dedicate full time to the company?
I think it gave me opportunity to explore just like different collaborations and kind of understand what the business of everything was.
What do you mean?
Just because, you know, I never came from media. I came from a design background and an agency background. And then I'm starting this brand that never existed before and nobody had an idea of what plating is. So, you know, that first couple years, it was really building a name for ourselves and then trying to understand, like, what are we and what is our position in the world? And how are we different than just a regular media website or a blog?
And how do you find that? How have you come to define yourself?
I mean, I definitely define ourselves as more of collaborators, and we're a media company, but that doesn't mean that we're just stuck in. We're definitely not just an Instagram page. I mean, I feel that, you know, we have our website and we're content creators and we're collaborators because we do amazing events and we're hosting different things. But I think it's more so about pushing this envelope and having a mission about plating. And that is what we want to, like, you know, talk about.
Getting out in the real world is probably a big part of the freedom you get when you leave the real-time hustle for the side hustle. And the side hustle becomes a real hustle. And I know that about 2 years ago, you traveled the world for about 10 months. What made you want to just pack a bag and go? What did you find beneficial just getting out on the road and leaving LA, which had been your home base of where you built this for such a long amount of time?
It's kind of funny because, well, you know, growing up, I didn't get the chance to travel the world. And I think that was always something inside of me. And I was always hustling and back to back, out of school, going into a job, and never really taking time off to explore a little bit. And I think, you know, that was kind of the catalyst. I was like, you know, I'm kind of tired of just being at a desk, and I built this amazing thing, and I want to go out there and I want to see and learn about plating, and I want to visit different restaurants, and I want to create content. And so I was just like, okay, I'm gonna close the office and travel for an entire year.
Now, it seems like a dream, but I'm sure there's a reality to it. And also, you wanting to create stuff while it wasn't just a vacation, it was you were creating stuff from it. How do you approach a trip like that for someone who might want to go out into the world themselves? Like, what's the best advice you have for someone who might want to go out on a venture and build their world into something larger?
I would say definitely have a game plan. You know, like, I mean, it's great to want to go to Paris for an entire month, but once you get to Paris and then you're not there and you're not prepared and you don't really have a game plan, people who you want to meet and things that you want to do, that could be a struggle.
Europeans are planners.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, there is not, like, there's not, like, a drop-in.
Once you get to the, you know, once you can get through in the email or something.
Yeah. And so you went with a plan, and how did you feel working with the international chef community versus the American community? Were they equally as receptive, more receptive? Did they get what you were doing with the art of plating? And was it easier because you had built up such a deep trove of work?
It was a lot. It was pretty easy. I mean, I'm actually really grateful, and I feel really blessed because we were in a great position at that time, too, that a lot of people knew what the art of plating was. So it wasn't a struggle for us to get in the door and meet with different people. And in general, I feel that the culinary community is extremely accepting.
Yeah. I mean, they're really, if they realize that you're for real, and that you respect their work and their time, then the doors will open. Mm-hmm. And speaking of opening doors, you have shifted into experiential as well. What made you want to go? Now you're beyond the Instagram page. You have the website. What made you want to get into the event world? Which today, I feel like there's a pop-up and a dinner for everything, every night, in every city. What were you bringing to the table?
I love collaborations, and I love the chefs that we work with. And I think it's amazing to be able to see beautiful food and all of that, but then it's a completely different thing to be able to experience that in person. And as somebody who loves to go out and dine and have all these experiences, I wanted to bring that to, you know, people that we know in our network and to guests. And so I think that's kind of what was the catalyst for that.
And when you're on site, I mean, obviously you're such an expert at shooting photographs, as I know, because we were at the same Maud dinner, and I looked at your photographs, and I looked at mine, and I went, I think we were at two different dinners, because yours look way better. But when you're at that, like, are you sharing your knowledge? Are you helping people? Like, is it a fun sort of community meetup as well, of people who want to, you know, see beautiful art, learn from someone who knows how to shoot food, and post their own photos?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm always there and people pick my brains all the time, which I'm totally for. But I think it's just more so like the whole experience of being able to taste the food and see the food and interact with the chef. Because sometimes, you know, if you're lucky, you get to interact with a chef. Yeah. And sometimes you're not as lucky. So being able to bring an experience is really important.
So as you start looking to the future and you have the events and you've expanded and now you have this international group of chefs, what's next? How do you keep pushing? How do you continue to differentiate yourself now that there's a, you know, 25 dozen other Instagram social pages, Facebook pages, things like that? Like, what's next? How do you stay one step ahead?
Mm-hmm. I think what's really important to me is keeping in touch with the community that we've built, which is all these amazing chefs and journalists and bloggers and, you know, kind of this really amazing community all over the world. And, you know, next year, looking forward, I'm trying to figure out ways how we can bring all of those people into one place. Ooh. So without giving
Art of Plating Con.
Without giving away too much, but, you know, I think that's something that would be really exciting.
Now, I want to end on one question, because I want to get back to storytelling a little bit. You've told a lot of stories, but is there one story that you've wanted to tell that you have yet to tell that you plan on telling in the next year or so?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, listen, thank you so much. If people want to check out The Art of Plating, where can they go?
They can go to on Instagram at The Art of Plating or theartofplating.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for making the time. Thank you for taking some beautiful photos. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey, are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Solstice One, a series of music centered around events in nature. The winter solstice, the longest night of the year, an ending and a beginning, a moment celebrated by mankind to help us understand our place in the universe, a time to reflect on our connection with nature. Find a moment for these musical passages. Listen, let go, and be.
Hey, Seaforth. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes.
How's it going?
We heard earlier in the program some tippy toes back from however many years that was.
Quite a few years
ago. It was quite a few years. It's so good to see you again.
Yeah, likewise.
In the solo form.
Yes.
In this, you ditched that dirtbag bandmate of yours and said, I'm on my own.
Yeah.
Your manifesto is beautiful.
Thank you.
And I'm really happy that we are getting you so close to the release of this record.
Yeah.
Let's start with the solstice for the uninitiated. What is it and why did you release a record on solstice?
Right. Well, the solstice is, that happens on December 21st. And I started thinking about how, it's around the holidays. And here we are. Gearing up for the holidays and it's Christmas and there's all these things associated to Christmas. And when you think back on it, it's really, Christmas is a Christian appropriation of the sort of pre-Christian pagan celebration of this momentous aligning of the planet and the sun and our rotation, and how it tilts towards the sun and away from the sun. So it's the shortest day of the year. As our planet is traveling through the cosmos.
And why did you decide to put a record out on solstice? And how far back did you have to start working to meet that deadline?
Well, the music had always been brewing. I've been working on this new type of music. And I needed to figure out a reason for why should anyone think to listen to abstract instrumental music. What is the purpose of abstract instrumental music?
What is the purpose of abstract instrumental music?
Well, the purpose that I thought was that meditation and reflection. And when thinking about the solstice and the holidays, I think about how far removed we are from nature these days. Ever since the advent of electricity, we have started to see the stars less and less. And here we are in the city, and we never see the stars. We see the North Star every now and then. We see the moon every now and then. But we don't really have any connection to what people used to see all but 150 years ago every night in all its glory, If you've been out, I'm sure you've traveled. When I was in Utah a couple years ago, actually seeing the Milky Way just blew my mind. And that used to be what all of mankind used to see every night.
Do you think it was mind-blowing for them or just like, ugh, the stars?
Well, no, I think it was...
Or just the terror of the night.
I think it was extremely mind-blowing for them. They, every ancient civilization aligned every monument, every building, every city to the relation to the stars. And it was, it's not really until, Christianity and also post-industrial revolution where then buildings got built based on building code and and stuff like that. So it's like our connection to nature and you know, us being spaceship Earth has disintegrated.
How do you find a connection to nature through electronic music?
Well, yeah, there's a bit of the paradox because I'm talking down on electronic and technology while using it. So the hope is that that's the bridge that allows people to connect. That people that, you know, we live in this technology world and that we're able to listen to electronics to help us then get back to nature. And the music hopefully reflects that. And there's, you know, there's mathematical aspects to it.
Such as?
Well, there can be, you know, different, there's numerology, you know, that can be applied. It's a bit arbitrary, I suppose, but like you can apply different types of numbers that represent nature. Obviously, math is a way to describe nature. And if you can try and grab some of these numbers, even loosely associated into the composition or the improvisation, then, you know, it's a more felt than heard kind of thing.
are there specific numbers that are tied to nature, or are there numbers that you were working with that you used as reference points?
Well, there are there are certain numbers. I mean, there's 13, 11, 7. These tend to be these more odd numbers. 6. These tend to represent different aspects. I can't really give you any specific things right now, but like it is all kind of arbitrary, but I think the intent of attaching to number to something still is part of the process in the creation.
Absolutely. I mean, when forming this, you need goalposts.
Yes.
You need guiding lights, if you will.
Yes.
And it's really interesting to hear mathematics and nature all through the electronic
Yes.
medium to guide you back to a starry sky.
Yeah.
From tippy toes to this, you said earlier in the interview that you were creating this new type of music. How has creating these songs evolved for you? Or what is the thought process into actually making it outside of the intangible numbers, nature? What is the actual technical methods that you use to do this?
Well, part of it's actually therapy. So I work as a music producer and mix people's music and work on their projects all the time. And this, it's a lovingly tedious job where every decision.
That's such a nice way to put it. For someone who has to continue to make a living this way, that is such a measured way of saying it.
Yeah, I just want to, you know.
And anyone listening goes, he's not talking about my project.
Yeah, exactly.
It's everyone else, not me. Abe and I have a thing.
Exactly. So to part of the process of this music is that it's it has an impermanence about it. It doesn't. I create these things, and they can never really be created again. I can't play the songs on the record again. They, you know, one little knob twist or something here creates a whole different set of events, and so I create something. I record it right to tape, and then it's done.
Great. No second guessing.
No second guessing, no editing.
The question does beg, how do you know when a snippet or a piece that you create it goes from experimental jam to that's one of the handful of representations, the current tangible form that I want to be indicative of this project?
Yeah, sure. It just has to speak to me in a certain way. And you know, there is ways to, I mean, I'm trying to think of song and form, and I'm like, and I might do a couple takes as well once I get a certain thing going and get it going and like, oh, that had a nice progression to it. And then, you know, it's my years of editing music and listening to it every day that I trust my instincts on what I think is good and what's bad.
It's like 10 minutes and 20 years.
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to nature.
Yeah.
I can't even say what you're going to play for us first. Is there even a title, or what are you going to do for us first?
Well, I'm going to start out very meditative. Very meditative.
Perfect. All right. Abe Seyfarth, Snacky Tunes.
Here we go.
Amazing. I mean, what am I supposed to say after that? What's a professional response to me? Just awesome. We covered, for anyone that's go back in the archives and listen to the Tippy Toes episode, we covered your work at DFA.
Right.
So instead of covering old ground, I want to cover new ground for your synth-laden recording studio, which anything that leads that way is just like, you know, jaw dropping. Like, I just want to say, how many senses do you need to be synth laden? If I had a diamond laden necklace, I would say it'd be covered in diamonds.
Right. It's pretty covered right now. There's lots going on in studio world right now.
And it's called Transmitter Park.
Transmitter Park.
Is it at Transmitter Park in Greenpoint?
It is. It's a block and a half away. It's just up the street. Yeah.
Like if you had to move your Lyft or Uber, they'd still pick you up down the street.
Yeah. That would be fine. There's lots going on. There's new partners involved, new people involved, renovations. I was painting the hallways with Morgan last night till about 2 a.m.
Morgan
Wiley. Yeah. Tippy Toes. He's one of my partners in the studio going forward now. And I've been renovating and doing all these things. And as we're doing that and like emptying out closets, we find even more synths.
I mean, have you gotten to the level yet where people are just giving you synths?
Yes, I am now.
That's the tipping point.
I would say I'm probably one of the number one foster care synth parents at this point.
I mean, considering that like you run in the DFA world, how many guys that, you know, maybe tried to start a band in that world and now they're a little bit older, they're like, look, I got two kids. I don't have any time for this, but like, I just want to make sure it has a good home. Maybe come look at it every once in a while.
Yeah, that happens. That happens. That happens. New York is a place, you know, where no one has any room. And as you start to clean out the studio, you realize how many things have been left behind.
So for building a studio in 2008, when did the studio start?
That's a good question. I think it was the first lease was signed in about 2008.
Okay. So 2008 to 2019, technology has changed. What makes a good studio and what advantages do you have now for focusing on synths that mm-hmm. makes you competitive or allows you to work with the artists that you want to work with?
Yeah, well, I'll break it down to a couple things. Specifically with synths, the world has changed in synths a lot in the last 10 years. And it used to be that synths, you had to go to a studio to get them. And they only had to be vintage. But now everyone, all the manufacturers are making them and reissuing them. And a lot of artists have since. So that's one thing that has changed in the last 10 years. When I worked at DFA, I mean, people would come just to record since. And sometimes that happens. Now it's more like there are producer tools for me. And I have my 5-6 synths that I use very carefully and do very specific things with, and I try to limit it to that.
Are you willing to name them, or is it a secretive thing?
I can name a few, sure. Okay. I mean, the Juno 106 is probably the most used synth. SH-101 still, the Moog Model D, Jupiter, MS-20. Those would probably be the top five.
And the ones that you are not naming,
yeah.
Why are you not naming them?
Maybe because I'm their foster parent. And I don't want to, they might disappear on any day right now. So I'm foster parenting a CS-80, which is great. And I'm going to use it a lot, but it could disappear at any day.
Is that a thing in the past where people won't say what they use? Is knowledge so readily available and you could kind of reverse engineer what a sound is? Or is that just not a thing anymore?
I mean, I think it varies person to person. You know, it's like, I mean, I know, you know, I just referencing James Murphy, for instance, like people would obsess about the drum sound and how a mystery it was. And then there's a whole article online about every last detail of what he did. And he's willing to share it. And I think most people are willing to share. I mean, it's a tricky thing because it's like the gear and stuff, it really doesn't matter. And sometimes if you're... Yeah, so it goes either way. I don't really care. I'll tell anyone anything.
Do you see yourself more as a Sherpa now or a guide to like, hey, I've got this amazing synth and I only know how to use 5% of it, and you help them unlock, you know, whatever secrets it might hold?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that definitely happens.
One of the things that you said to me I thought was interesting is that you were part of New York City's underground improvised music scene.
Yes.
How big of a scene is that, and who are some of the players in it?
Well, it's been... When I first moved to New York City, it was probably my most active time, and that was back in 2001, 2002, Tonic was around. I don't know if you remember Tonic.
Yes, and for all of those who don't know what it is, please go read Meet Me in the Bathroom for your slice of early 2000 New York history.
Yeah, so there's Tonic, there was Zebulon, and I played in various groups, played in a group Droid, played in a group Elliptical Ferns, and... at the time, I was doing a lot of sort of hybrid guitar and synth improvisation. And I was also attending the New School for Improvisational Music at the time and performing with some of my professors and some of my classmates, and kind of got derailed for a bit, but with studio stuff. And now I've gotten back into it. One of the main people I've been performing with lately is Jason Lindner. He's sort of synth jazz guru, I guess, but he played on the latest Bowie record. And he's been doing a lot more sort of synth improvised music stuff. So, yeah.
And the community is strong here, strong elsewhere. And what are some of the venues that you play now? RIP Tonic, RIP Zebulon.
Yeah, I mean, New Blue is still holding it together in that regards. And
love then, a good New Blue night out.
Yeah. And then, I mean, there are, it's more the unconventional places, which I'm trying to think of right now. That it's very interesting to try and find the right spots for this kind of music.
Does the room dictate it, or is it an acoustic thing? Is it an audience, or what makes a good
Well, it propositional spot.
Well, yeah, the room can dictate it a little bit because if you know it's a type of place where drinks are being served and it's Friday at 10 o'clock, like yeah, you know, maybe I wouldn't play that last piece. might have a kick drum underneath it or something like that to play the room, so to speak. But you know, so what makes a good space is always, I mean, for me. At least it's always the sound system. It's number one. And because I'm now old and tired, close to my apartment.
Just a parameter. Just a parameter. If you could make it work for me, that would be great. one of the things I noticed when, to bring it back to the record, is on the music tags, you have all the things, but you also have devotional.
Yeah,
which I absolutely loved, and obviously a decision. There aren't like 1,000 tags. There's maybe 4 or 5 tags for genres.
Yeah,
how did you land there, and how do you see this being used in that sense of music?
Well, it goes when I think about going back to the solstice and the point of having music, you know, and giving people a reason to listen to this, it does sort of start to get slightly religious in a way. And I think that people these days, we don't believe in anything anymore. And if music could be a religion, that would be a wonderful thing. And if people could believe in music and use music as a way of belief and somehow tie that into, once again, the connection to nature, that would make me very happy. So that's the short answer to that.
Can we expect more knowing that June 21st is on the horizon?
Yes, yes, for sure, for sure. And I'm not going to even limit it to solstices per se. But yeah, I think June definitely gives me enough time.
Perfect. Well, Abe, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people hear the record? How can they follow you? Find out where your gigs are? Book some time at Transmitter?
Yeah, all these things. I mean, the Instagram seems to be the easiest way to get a hold of me from any sort of person. I'm not really on Twitter or Facebook these days, but and then the album's on Bandcamp, it's on Spotify, it's on every possible digital way to listen to things.
And what's its Instagram handle?
It's just Abe Seyfrith. So that's AbeSeyfrith.
Perfect. We want to thank the Art of Plating for being on the show today. Abe, thank you for coming in. Jeet, we appreciate you as always. We will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. I would say, what's the name you're going to take us out with? But just take us out. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.